It's 906.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Have you heard? The Panthers are in the playoffs. They take on the San Francisco 49ers on Sunday afternoon at Bank of America Stadium. It's been a long time since the team has made the playoffs, and not something most people anticipated at the beginning of this season. So, with that in mind, we spend some time toward the end of today's program taking a look at what might be in store this weekend and hopefully in the weeks ahead. But first, we turn our attention to recent changes in the law that may impact not only the home building and real estate industries, but you if you're looking to buy or sell a home. After being critically injured during the Great Recession, the home building industry is recovering nicely. Around the country, builders are building and home sales are rising along with home prices. But changes in lending laws may have a negative impact on this recovery, and we're going to look into that with Frank Noteft, the Vice President and Chief Economist with Freddie Mac, which provides mortgage capital to lenders and which makes home buying possible for one in four people taking out mortgages in the United States. He joins us by phone from McLean, Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
You're welcome. And here in our Spirit Square studio is Eric Locker, 2013 past president of the Charlotte Regional Realtor Association and the Carolina Multiple Listing Service. Thank you for being with us as well. And Dr. Scott Frame, the Belk Distinguished Professor of Business and Professor of Finance at UNC Charlotte. Dr. Frame is currently on leave from the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, where he was a financial economist and senior policy advisor, and during the fall of 2008 was a special advisor to the Treasury Department and assisted with the conservatorships for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So I guess you became Mr. Noteft's boss at that point, right?
Don't want to say that, Mike.
Let me begin with you, Dr. Frame. Last year, the home building and the real estate industry began to show signs of life, with housing starts up, home sales up, home prices up. Why? What was driving that?
Well, I think a couple of factors there. I think one is the slow improvement in the economy overall, as well as the Federal Reserve's actions to continue to buy mortgage-backed securities to keep mortgage interest rates very low, which stimulated housing demand.
And this was going on all over the country. Is that not right, Mr. Noteft? In most cities around the country, this is going on.
Oh, that's absolutely right. We've seen a pickup in housing demand, sales, starts, house prices. For instance, just in the Charlotte metro area, house prices are up approximately 10% or so just over the last year. So that's, I think, a good example of what we're seeing elsewhere in so many markets around the country. And as Scott pointed out, it's really kind of affordability. It's these very low mortgage rates that the Federal Reserve has been able to bring to the marketplace that's helped to drive a high degree of affordability for potential home buyers, helping to bring people back into the market, translating into more home sales and translating into new construction.
And Eric Locker, I know it's kind of perverse because during the Great Recession, it was a great time to buy a house if you could afford to do it. It was a great time because prices were low and interest rates were historically low, and yet people didn't do it because they were afraid that if they got into a house, the price of the house that they bought yesterday would be lower tomorrow. Now, as he just said, prices are up 10% in Charlotte, give or take a few percentage points. So is now still a good time to buy a house?
It is still a good time.
Is it a good time to sell a house?
It's a great time to sell a house. Inventories are down, but the interest rates are still low. So, and predictions have been for the last several months that interest rates will be going up, but they are still low. So if you have the decent enough credit scores to borrow, it is a great time to buy a house.
The Multiple Listing Service reports that the number of contracts for home sales as of January 7th was up 10.9% compared to last December, up 17.3% for all of last year compared to 2012, and the number of new listings has also increased. What does this tell you about buyer and seller confidence in the market?
It says that both are having great confidence in it. They are meeting at a point where buyer and seller are agreeing on pricing, and that they are seeing that it is time to make contracts happen.
But people were looking for real bargains during the recession. Have the real bargains gone away?
Well, they've gone away in the sense that the bargain hunters have found what they were going to find. Sellers have said, this is as low as I'm going to go, and buyers are finally coming up to where the sellers
need
to be.
And when buyers hear, or when sellers hear, that the home prices are increasing, are they tending to accurately price the homes they want to sell, or are they going for more than you think is realistic?
Not more than is realistic. They are finally going where both are agreeing that they need to be. And that is a point that needs to be made, is that sellers need to be realistic on their pricing. It doesn't mean that they can sell them for whatever they want to be. They need to be realistic.
I was speaking to some mortgage brokers toward the end of last year, which was only, 10 days ago. And they all spoke about these impending changes in the lending laws that are going to change qualifying criteria. And at the time, some of them were talking about being uncertain about exactly what those changes would mean or who they would affect. Uncertainty is never good in a marketplace. Has the uncertainty gone away? Because these laws go into place today. Are people fully aware, mortgage lenders, brokers, real estate people, are they fully aware of what these law changes entail now, as of today?
But I think what's important is to keep in mind that it affects a certain segment of the market, an important segment of the market, but not the entire mortgage lending industry. So FHA loans, VA loans, very popular in the marketplace right now, are not affected by these new rules. And those conventional loans that are sold to Freddie Mac or to Fannie Mae have an exemption as well for a period of time. So that helps to soften the blow. And certainly for home buyers, especially first-time home buyers, it's the low down payment products, such as what's offered through FHA or through conventional loans with private mortgage insurance. Those are really what really help to finance first-time home buyers. So largely, that part of the market is not as impacted.
You want to comment on that, Dr. Frame?
No, I agree with Frank that this is really sort of aimed at what's known as the qualified mortgage rule, and it was part of the Dodd-Frank Act. And the newly created Consumer Protection Financial Bureau put out guidance, what they've called the qualified mortgages. And it's really designed to sort of set up a box or a matrix, if you will, that sort of defines sort of what is a preferred mortgage product. And creates sort of a legal safe harbor around that. And that encompasses the vast majority of what we think of as the mortgage market. And what's on the outside are things that I think during the last boom and bust were perceived to be particularly risky loans or risky products. So it does create some uncertainty for brokers that might be looking to put people in, would have in the past tried to put people into those products, but not sort of your conventional mortgages.
Because beginning today, these new laws take effect in response to that meltdown 7 years ago. It will make lenders unable to sell a mortgage that a borrower cannot reasonably repay. I'm paraphrasing here, but that seems sensible to me. So two questions. What took so long to reach that process, and what's wrong with that?
There were a lot of high-risk products that were being originated in the marketplace in 2004, 5, and 6. Some people may even say some of the underwriting got to be very very weak, and some of these products were not in the best interest of the borrower or indeed of anyone really in the industry. And so there may have been some abuses in the lending industry at that time. And what's really so important, and what I think this rule tries to address, is to offer financing products that assure that the homeowner has a successful experience as a homeowner. That is, putting them in a product that they can afford and sustain their ownership over time.
Beginning today, I'm going to read from this law. Beginning today, lenders must verify and document at least 8 specific criteria, including income, assets, credit history, other debt obligations, and employment status, to determine whether a borrower has a reasonable chance of repaying the loan. If the lender doesn't do all of that, a homeowner who has trouble repaying the loan has grounds for a lawsuit. So this kind of protects both sides in a way, does it not?
I think that it does, and I think that's for the benefit not only of that individual but for the public in, at large.
So if I, as a borrower, get in trouble with my loan 5 years from now that I was given for this house that I want to buy, how do I determine whether whether it's my fault or your fault, the mortgage broker, for giving me something I can't afford?
That's an interesting question that may end up being in the courts.
Yeah, I think that ends up being a legal question.
Okay. The new law also banned some other practices that proved risky in the housing bubble. Terms longer than 30 years are out. The option to pay less than the full monthly interest is no longer an option. No balloon payments. Fees and points cannot add up to more than 3% of the loan. These sound all particularly good for borrowers, it seemed to me. How do lenders view these things?
Well, I think an important point is, back to your question just a moment ago, what happened was lenders were basically saying, I'm just making the loan, I'm selling it to Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae, and it's their problem from that point on.
Well, let's hear from Freddie Mac then, because it became a serious problem.
That's right.
For Freddie Mac and Fannie
Mae.
And
now it's back to the lender to say it becomes their problem again.
How do you view these law changes? This must be a good thing for you.
And many of the high-risk loans that were originated back in 04, 05, 06, many of them actually were financed through private label securitization. So that would be a secondary market that's outside of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. And what we're talking here is a lot of the subprime loans and a lot of what was called Alt-A or alternative A credit loans, which are really the no-income, no-asset verification or stated income, stated asset loans that were originated at the time. And what you were describing, Mike, in terms of some of the parameters of the rule, try to address what was seen by policymakers as unwise and maybe abusive underwriting practices, that is, the no-income, no-asset verification and the extensive subprime lending, which put many borrowers into products which were not sustainable over time, in part because payments would ratchet up over a relatively short period of time, and the borrower would be in a position where they couldn't afford the monthly payments anymore.
How careful do you have to be when you start tinkering with things like this on a national policy basis, given the fact that home buying and selling, the home industry, drives a big, big part of the American economy? How careful do you have to be, Dr. Frank?
Well, I think...
You've got to be pretty careful, I think. And that's one reason it's taken so long for the policymakers and for the CFPB to generate the final rule. And indeed, they put out a proposed rule first that generated a great deal of comment from the industry and from consumer groups. And the CFPB, I thought, did a good job trying to incorporate the comments from many different groups and come out with a final rule that it felt was very workable.
I'm going to get to Dr. Scott Frame's take on this in just a second. We have to take a break, and we'll come back with more with Frank Notaft, who's the Vice President and Chief Economist for Freddie Mac, Eric Locker, past President of the Charlotte Regional Realtor Association, and Dr. Scott Frame, a Belk Distinguished Professor of Business and Finance at UNC Charlotte. We're talking about the new laws that are going into effect today and other aspects of home buying and selling and the industry that surrounds all of that on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and College Transition Connection, helping students who have an intellectual disability attend college, develop life skills, and learn to live independently. Support, guidance, and financial aid are available. Details at welcometocollegelife.com. Well, with so many of our food choices revolving around processed and fast foods, we're beginning to see a lot of negative health consequences of that. Obesity is one, but another of them is diabetes, the incredible rising number of diabetes. And in fact, at Carolina's healthcare system, that is the number one disease that they treat. So they've gotten together with the YMCA to work on a program to help people recognize the signs of diabetes, change their eating habits, and even reverse the effects. And we'll talk to them about it Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. On the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty, both political parties focus on income inequality. The Supreme Court halts same-sex marriage in Utah, and the latest job numbers.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Frank Notaff from Freddie Mac, Eric Locker from the Charlotte Regional Realtor Association, Dr. Scott Frame from UNC Charlotte. Let me get your take on what Mr. Notaff just said before the break, Dr. Frame, about these changes in lending laws and having to be careful about this because the economy is driven in large part by the home industry.
Well, housing is certainly an important component of the economy. I actually have a little different take on it, which is that you need to be careful when you're making these sort of broad brush changes around the country because real estate markets are inherently sort of local. And so you need to understand, differences in, price movements, custom, things like this where, there have been a history of products. For example, the CFPB has sort of pushed back against like 40-year mortgages. You talk about loans where you didn't have to make your full payment, or even I don't know that they've necessarily prohibited interest-only loans, but they also had a bad name. But these are products that periodically appear in the marketplace, usually in markets where prices are rising very rapidly. And they're viewed as affordability products. They're a way for people to lower their monthly payment and get into the house. Unfortunately, what happens, and I think was very consistent with what we saw in the mid-2000s, is it's sort of like feeding you have a rise in prices or a bubble beginning to form, and then the funding side sort of feeds that by providing more credit to more and more people. And it allows prices to continue to rise perhaps further than they otherwise would. And I think, on both sides of the marketplace, those last people getting in are really both the home buyers and the lenders are really counting on home price appreciation to make deals work. And that's when that starts to happen, that's a big flag.
And I know that realtors across the country are saying that homes are remain a good investment. Could you have said that 3 years ago? And are they really an investment? Because people were using them like piggy banks before the recession.
Well, they are not piggy banks. And that has come to be the case. And we have I think the Realtor Association and realtors in general have – those who know the marketplace have not emphasized that per se. And it's important to note that the purchase price and the way that you purchase a home should be – you should look at that as not a way to make it a total investment, but as a way to – look at it as the most important way to buy to look at a house as an investment is to purchase it right so that when you sell it, you will have made money over the long term.
Part of the problem prior to the recession, along with people getting into it was the people getting into homes they couldn't afford and getting into loan products that were not structured for them to understand or for them to understand that they couldn't afford the loan ultimately. So a lot of that is due to consumer ignorance, a lack of consumer education when it came to loan products and buying a loan. Has that changed any? Are people smarter today, more educated today because of the recession about what they should and should not do? And are they being helped to see what they should and should not do, either by realtors or by lending institutions?
I believe both are true. Both lending institutions and educated realtors are doing a much better job of
that. Educated realtors. Are
yes.
not all realtors educated? They have to be certified, don't they?
Well, they definitely have to be. They definitely have to be educated, and especially in North Carolina, they have to pass many tests. And we have continuing education for them. Mm-hmm. Just like in any industry, there are excellent those who practice their profession on a very professional level, and those that need to do a better job of it.
So, as a result of these rule changes that are clamping down somewhat or raising qualifications for people to be able to get into certain loan products, are they going to put a severe damper on the market in your view, or are they going to be just weeding out people who ultimately would have failed and therefore it's a wash? In other words, if you can't get a loan for the house that you want because you don't meet all these new criteria,
right.
Is that a bad thing for you as realtors? Or is it a good thing because ultimately they would have failed in the loan and we've probably gone to foreclosure and that would have caused problems down the road?
We think it's a good thing. There's a short-term pain because that person can't purchase the home, but eventually someone will purchase that loan. What we're finding is homes are being purchased now. Mm-hmm. The market is moving. What we actually have is a shortage of inventory.
Right.
We actually have too little homes for people to purchase.
And is that because they're not being built fast enough or because previously owned homes are not being put on the market?
Both. We have a shortage of both existing homes and we have a shortage of new homes on the market.
And in terms of the existing homes, why aren't people putting them on the market?
A couple things. One, people heard over the last couple of years that prices were rising, and the thought was, well, if I hold my home off the market for a period of time, it will be worth more tomorrow than it is today, so I'll wait for it to increase in value. And two, they couldn't find the home into which they wished to move, mm-hmm. so they were waiting to see what they were looking for that home they wanted to buy.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the other changes that are being considered in Washington in the coming months or years, including the dissolution of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Given how much Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were in the news during the financial crisis, I'm sure that most people understand what these entities are and what they do, but perhaps not. So give us a primer. What does Freddie Mac do, Mr. Freddie Mac, Frank Notaft?
Sure. Freddie Mac is a secondary mortgage market company. What that means is that we buy the mortgages that are made by banks, mortgage companies, credit unions, and then we package them into mortgage-backed securities and issue or sell the mortgage-backed securities into the broader capital markets. That allows us to tap the global capital markets and channel funds from those markets back to Main Street America so that the banks can replenish the funds that they've used to make loans in order to make additional loans. So that's what Freddie Mac does. Fannie Mae does pretty much exactly the same thing as well.
And you came into existence in the 1970s charged with the idea of stabilizing the nation's residential mortgage markets and expanding opportunities for home ownership and affordable rental housing. Since you buy and sell these loans, where did the initial capital for you to start doing that in the 1970s come from?
Oh, the initial capital came from the Federal Home Loan banks. So there are 12 Federal Home Loan banks, and in our charter that comes from Congress in 1970, the initial common stock capitalization for Freddie Mac came from the 12 Federal Home Loan banks.
So all of this seemed to work pretty well for a very long time. What happened?
Well, you'll hear different explanations from different folks on it, but there's no question that the market got extremely overheated with house prices becoming frothy or bubbly, and beyond fundamental values in many markets around the country. And these high-risk products came into the marketplace. We talked briefly about some of them, what's called Alt-A loans and subprime loans. And many of them were packaged and sold not to Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, but sold through private label securities, and in that way sold into the broader capital markets. The underwriting quality began to deteriorate in general in the mortgage lending industry. And if you combine very low down payment products with weak underwriting, you're asking for trouble. So, and that's basically what happened. And but, I think Scott mentioned earlier, as long as house prices keep escalating, as they had been, that'll help to mask a lot of the underwriting issues. But house prices were already above their fundamental true value. And as they started to come down, it really exposed all of the risks in the mortgage lending system.
Did people at Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae and other institutions that do what you do or something like what you do, did they see this coming? Did they understand that this was inevitable? Or did they really think, like a lot of us thought, well, this is never going to change. It's always going to keep going up.
No, we didn't think it was always going to go up, but I don't think anyone foresaw that nationally house prices were going to fall 25-30%. And in some markets, because as Scott mentioned, the housing market is really local in nature. It's not really a national housing market. And in some local markets, we've seen house prices fall 60-70%. I think that would have been very hard for anyone to foresee.
You're a professor of finance, and people in this business, one would assume, are educated in the business that they're in. Should they have seen it coming? Should they have understand the underlying principles were built on sand?
Well, I think that's going a little too far. But, I mean, I think there were economists, and Frank's aware of this too, that began to see sort of a there's sort of a long-run stable relationship between home prices and rents. And in the mid-2000s, that relationship began to become unhinged. Mm-hmm. And people began to look at that and measure it and say, hey, you know, it looks like house prices are 20-25% overvalued. I think this is sort of Bob Shiller's thesis. People were aware of this, were concerned about it. But I think to Frank's point, thinking that they would correct that much that fast – was something that people hadn't really appreciated or taken into account.
As a result of the crisis, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have been operating under the control of the Federal Housing Finance Agency, which was established as a result of the crisis in 2008. How have they been operating differently as a result of all this, and how long will this, I guess, conservatorship go on?
Well, they have, you know, one of the key components was the conservatorship. The idea is to conserve the assets of the firms and to make sure that they're continuing to operate and meet their congressional charters or their statutory missions, which is to provide liquidity and stability to the market. And by having the government take them over, they were able to continue to do that. I think, you know, one of the big changes is they began to certainly tighten credit standards in order to become eligible for their programs. The types of loans that they were taking into their programs had to be of much higher quality, and the underwriting underlying those had to be much more buttoned down. And so, you know, that creates a tension because on one hand you're saying, okay, you know, these firms were bankrupt. They need to really do their job well and focused and make good loans. On the other hand, right. You know, when you're in the middle of a housing crash, you don't want to crush demand at that time either. So there's a little bit of a tension there.
The Federal Housing Finance Agency has been operating with no real agency head for 4 years now. And Mel Watt, North Carolina Congressman Mel Watt, just took over was just appointed as the head of that agency. Why so long to get a guy in charge, and what does he bring to the table?
Well, you know, I think in terms of how long, you know, I personally, you know, I think we're all sort of aware of the challenges in Congress that have been going on in terms of getting appointments made. But the Obama administration, they had nominated one individual about 3 years ago, but nominated them right at the end of a year. And so that nomination never went anywhere. They weren't really anxious to replace this agency head. And so the FHFA was really run by civil service.
Right.
You know, I think that really, in my opinion, served us well. I think you know, Mr. Watt's going to come in and, you know, revisit the policies and the direction that are going on. But I think given the political climate and the politics around housing finance reform, it's possible that, you know, in my personally talking to people in Washington, you know, they're saying they're not looking for any movement on any serious movement on this issue until after the next presidential election. And so we're going to be in this position, it looks like, for a while.
You say that House Republicans would like to simply liquidate Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Why and what would be the impact of that?
Well, I think one reason is you know, these entities, as you know, Frank mentioned in their charters, to provide liquidity and stability to the mortgage market. I mean, during most normal times, what they're doing is they're leveraging their relationship with the federal government, and this does transmit into some liquidity that's effectively created by the government. And it allows mortgage rates to be a little bit lower than they otherwise would be. And so really it's a way to sort of provide a small subsidy to housing finance. The part where and so people sort of, I think from the Republican side, sort of view that as sort of a socially wasteful and sort of, at least before they were part of the federal government, and sort of a wasteful and opaque subsidy that goes to housing finance. I think the issue that gets discussed now is more about, well, what happens when you hit these turbulent times. And here you have some federal government backstop that can ensure that mortgage rates remain relatively low during periods of financial disruption.
And about 2 minutes left. Over in the Senate, there's a bill working its way through that would allow regulated private securitization firms to purchase government insurance for pools of mortgages to make them riskless and liquid, and to insulate them from gyrations in the market. This is gonna make people's heads swim, but how does that differ, Frank Notaff, from what Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae have been doing all along?
Well, one element that it tries to address is to make the guarantee of the mortgage-backed securities explicit. So one concern was that investors in the past had viewed that there was an implicit federal backing of the mortgage-backed securities issued by Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, even though both organizations and Congress tried to make it clear that there was no federal guarantee or backing of the securities, and yet many investors still felt implicitly there was some type of backstop. So one thing the bill, as you described it, tries to address with this type of federal insurance of mortgage-backed securities is to make it explicit and clear what the extent of the federal government's role is. And they will be guaranteeing, under that bill, they'd be guaranteeing the mortgage-backed securities that investors purchase. So, and I think another policy choice made by many policy people is that they want to have more in some sense, competition in the secondary market. And so they envision having multiple organizations, not just the Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, but other entities that have access to pool mortgages
Let me stop you there because we are out of time. I wish we had more time because I have a lot more questions, but unfortunately they're not going to get asked or answered. To Frank Notaft, Chief Economist for Freddie Mac, Eric Locker, past president of the Charlotte Regional Realtor Association, and Dr. Scott Frame from UNC Charlotte. Thanks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Invest Collegiate, Charlotte's public college preparatory charter school, engaging children and the community. Information session Sunday at 2 p.m. Details at investcollegiate.org. On the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty, both political parties focus on income inequality, the Supreme Court halts same-sex marriage in Utah, and the latest job numbers coming out. A panel of journalists talk to Diane Rehm about all of that in the weekly news hour, the national hour first at 10 o'clock in 20 minutes, and the international hour at 11 o'clock. We, however, talk about something far more important, the Panthers playoff game Sunday when we come back.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. On the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty, both political.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We cannot end the show or the week without a nod to something big, even momentous, that happens this weekend. The Carolina Panthers play their first playoff game in years at home against the San Francisco 49ers on Sunday. Now, few would have predicted a playoff berth for the team at the beginning of the season, and yet here we are, and since we beat the 49ers earlier in the season, this may just be the first playoff game this year for the team. What, did that make any sense? No. I don't think that made any sense. On the other hand,
it is true, though. It will absolutely be the first game.
I'm just
the first playoff game.
I'm so amazed that we're even talking about this that nothing makes sense. On the other hand, since we beat San Francisco, they may be looking for revenge. To find out what role that might play in Sunday's game and to get a clearer picture of what the Panthers' chances at victory might be, we've invited Scott Fowler to join us again. He is a sports reporter for the Charlotte Observer who has been to almost every Panther game since the inception of the franchise. Scott joins us by phone. Welcome back, Scott.
Thank you, Mike. Glad to be back.
You're welcome. And with us here in the studio, the guy laughing profusely at me is is WFAE's own Michael Tomsic, a sometimes, well, former guest host of this program, who has also decided to keep his day job as a reporter for WFAE News. And in the course of doing that job, has spoken to Riverboat Ron Rivera, the coach of the Panthers, as well as Cam Newton, Steve Smith, Luke Kuechly, and other players. Thank you for being here, too.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So to both of you, how did this happen? Why are we having this conversation?
Scott?
Well, Mike, the most obvious reason the Panthers have gotten so good is their defense. Now, offense is the glamorous part of almost every sport, but defense is what ultimately wins championships. And the Panthers' defense is doggone good. They're number two in the NFL in a whole lot of categories. San Francisco's defense, I should mention, is also very good, but that's where it's begun. Also, you mentioned Riverboat Ron, the gambling coach they've got now. And Cam Newton has matured in his third year and has become a much better player in the fourth quarter.
Now, at the beginning of the season, everybody was talking about Ron Rivera being fired and possibly being fired during the season. And all of a sudden, he's being rumored as the NFL coach of the year. How did he turn around the team?
I mean, you think, to your point, I mean, so they were 1-3 at the beginning of the season and then have just reeled off wins since. And one of the ways that he's done that is in some of these kind of big situations, he's earned this nickname Riverboat because of, you know, gambling on fourth downs. But in this league, you have to take some of those gambles. They actually work out better for you. And you know, there were some close games where he didn't make those calls earlier in his coaching career with the Panthers.
Right.
He's been making those now. That's obviously not the entire reason for the turnaround, but you can just tell this team, and I think the coach is included in this, just has this real level of confidence in its ability to make big plays in big situations.
You mentioned, Scott, that we have the number two defense in the NFL. Our offense is not quite as strong. We all think it's easy to see how the defense is better and so strong because of what they have accomplished on the field. What has to happen to make the offense equal to the defense?
Yeah, well, you know, they're probably not. It's not going to happen this year, Mike, is the bottom line. They're just going to have to be good enough. They'll need to upgrade in the offseason at a couple of positions, including wide receiver and offensive line. But this week, you know, they beat San Francisco, as you mentioned, in the open there, but they only beat them 10-9. The offense only scored 10 points, and I don't think 10's going to get it done this week. I think the first team that gets to 20 points is going to win.
This is the first playoff game for Ron Rivera ever in his history,
yeah.
Right, in his career. So it's a big deal for him, and he says that one of his keys this Sunday will be to contain the quarterback for the 49ers, right, Michael?
Exactly. So one of the things that he pointed out through the course of this week in press conferences was the Niners have this young quarterback, Colin Kaepernick, who has a laser for an arm, can run really fast, and this may sound familiar to Panthers fans because we have a guy like that too. His name is Cam Newton. And Coach Rivera pointed out that, as much of a threat as Kaepernick will be, the Niners will have that same sort of a challenge with Cam Newton. And here's what he said.
We'll have the same, we'll have the same situation, set of circumstances that they have. You know, they've got to defend a prolific style passer, and at the same time, a guy that's got the ability to tuck the ball and run.
So really, this is going to be a key thing. And in the Niners' first round win in the playoffs last weekend, there was this huge play where it was a third down. The Niners were trying to drive to take the lead, and Kaepernick broke free of a big blitz and just sprinted for the first down. And that's the kind of thing that Rivera pointed out is something that the Panthers cannot let happen. They have to keep him contained this weekend.
Who's the better quarterback?
Well, I think it's about a tie, honestly. Those two are just about equal. And I think, Mike, that Cam Newton has to play as well as Colin Kaepernick on Sunday. Kaepernick is a lot better than he was 2 months ago. And if those two equal out, I think the Panthers' defense is slightly better than San Francisco's defense, and I think they can win. But if Cam Newton bottoms out and Kaepernick has a great game, then we know what will happen.
Now, Steve Smith says in the paper this morning that at practice yesterday, he felt like he was 57%. But that's a pretty accurate number.
Well, and he was 71% the day before, which of course makes you wonder, is this more just Steve kind of having fun with everybody as opposed to actually? I mean, he's going to play, Scott, right? Do you have any doubt that he'll play?
No doubt that he'll play. They've got to have him on the field, Michael, I think, just because, he's just, if nothing else, he's a great decoy. They're not doing well without him, so they're going to have to activate him. But I wonder how effective he will be.
He's like the glove to Cam's hand. So when he's not on the field, is it disconcerting for Newton?
Oh, yeah, I think definitely. He and Greg Olsen, the tight end, are the two people that Newton always looks to when he's in trouble. And he's got to have those two guys on the field, and he's got to make, Cam Newton's going to have to make some big plays. It's his first playoff game, too, just like it's Ron Rivera's.
So the heat is on. You've said that he has matured, and part of maturing in the NFL is to have that sense of confidence that you're as good as everybody else on the field. That's what it takes to win, it would seem to me. So has he reached that stage? It's a first playoff game for him.
It is the first playoff game, but one thing that we have seen him do this season is make big plays in big pressure situations. He's led some game-winning drives late in games. He's converted some very big fourth downs. So, obviously everything gets ramped up in the playoffs, but at least so far we do have this kind of small sample size this season of him having to make plays and him actually making those plays.
When we last played San Francisco, both teams were 6-3, and we beat them, I think, 10-9, and sacked the quarterback six times on their field. It was called the worst game of Colin Kaepernick's career. Things like that happen. It could have been an off day for him. Now we're 12-4. They are 13-4. Will this be a similar matchup or a completely different kind of game?
Well, my thought is it'll be a similar matchup but higher scoring. I mean, these defenses haven't gone anywhere. They're still very good, so we're not going to see a game that's 38-35 Sunday. However, Kaepernick didn't have two of his primary weapons, his receivers, in that game, and those guys are back. And so to think that the Panthers are going to hold San Francisco to 9 is probably unrealistic.
The 49ers website, which I went to yesterday, says that their quarterback, and they make a big deal out of this, is 2-0 on the road in the playoffs and has the most postseason road wins by a starting quarterback in the history of their team. I left out the adjective they used to describe their team.
Yeah.
He's also 3-1 during his postseason career, giving him four more playoffs, they point out, four more playoff appearances than Cam Newton. What kind of psychological advantage does that give him or them?
At least for what Coach Rivera, he got asked about, you know, playoff experience. Does it matter, playoff experience? You don't have playoff experience all the time this week. And he always had the same answer, and that's, look, we approach each game as it is the next biggest game that we have because it's the next game that we're about to play. You can tell that the team, the other veterans, have been saying those same things. They're trying to get the guys like Cam Newton ready. They know that, you know, you have to make these big plays now. You don't get another shot. But at the same time, I mean, I think that to some degree, we just don't know exactly how these less experienced guys will perform because it's their first time in this big of a spotlight.
It was earlier in the season that we played the 49ers in San Francisco, yeah, and they lost to us on their field. Won't the revenge factor have come into play on Sunday?
Well, I think yes, in some ways. But honestly, if you can't get up for this game, I mean, everyone's going to be revving at 150% already for this game. I mean, the crowd I expect to be one of the best in franchise history. The tickets, the single game tickets sold out in 3 minutes a couple of weeks ago. This is going to be an enormous game, and as much as the 49ers want to win it, the Panthers want to win it too. It's just going to, bottom line will be who plays better on the field. It won't be about Ric Flair. It won't be about ice up front. It's just going to be who doesn't make turnovers and plays a little bit better.
And to Scott's point, yeah, I mean, it's the playoffs. I don't really buy the revenge thing as a factor. If you can't get pumped to try to go win a playoff game, if you need any extra motivation for that.
Wait a minute. You've watched some Super Bowls, haven't you? Some of the dullest games ever played, some of them. And it's the Super Bowl. So it is conceivable that you can't get up for this game.
I don't know. I think those are more just mismatches as compared to like one team phoning it in. I mean, it's the Super Bowl. Everyone's ready to play.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Go back and look at some of the tapes.
Okay. I'll do some research for you.
So what do we have to do to own this game? And I think we have to own this game to win it, don't we?
Well, they're going to, you know, what I would say, Mike and Michael, is that they're going to have to run the ball somewhat effectively. The Panthers would like to make it sort of a ball control type game and not get in a big shootout and let their defense sort of ultimately own it. That's where they're going to, you know, they made Colin Kaepernick look like a terrible JV quarterback the first time they played him. Sacked him 6 times. He looked rattled. He was running around like a chicken with his head cut off. And that's the sort of Kaepernick they want to see again, and they have to do it really with a big-time pass rush.
Well, that brings us to this, because Ron Rivera has said that we caught Kaepernick at a good time for the Panthers, and he doesn't expect that we'll have an easy time of it this time, particularly considering how he's performed in recent games. And now he knows, Kaepernick knows, how we play and that he will be targeted by our four-man front. So surely the 49ers have a plan to work around that.
And that's football. I mean, you know, that's why Steve Smith, one of like my favorite things I heard one of the players say this week. He's like, when you play two teams, you know, the same time in the same season, you always get two different games. I mean, it's just different. Yeah. I mean, you look at how New Orleans, and he made this point, you look at how New Orleans just mopped the floor with us in New Orleans. Then they came back to Charlotte and Carolina beat them to take the division lead. So I think it's really tough to put too much weight on, you know, exactly how well we the Panthers handled Kaepernick in the first game.
You want to comment on that, Scott?
Yeah, I would, you know, agree to that to some extent. But I think also the players are mostly the same here. So I don't think you're going to get an incredibly different game. I also think the coaches are going to make a big impact on this game. I've written a big story for Sunday's newspaper, which, by the way, is going to have an enormous Panther special section. Please check that out. But it's on Rivera, and whether can he continue to be Riverboat Ron in the biggest of all the situations he's ever faced? Can he continue to make this big-time gamble? And kind of goes through the process of how he's gotten to where he is. And, you know, that we're not going to know that until we see him actually make that fourth down call.
Now, the Panthers have had a week off. That's helpful in terms of getting rest. It's helpful in terms of injuries like Steve Smith's, maybe having some time to heal a little bit more than it would have if he had to play last week. But could it be dangerous for losing momentum? Or is that the kind of thing that they've been psyched up since 2 weeks ago for this?
I would guess that. And also, I mean, so getting that week off means a home playoff game. It means getting to rest Steve Smith so that he'll actually be more ready to play. To me, I mean, the upsides are, you know, alternatively, would you have rather gone and played on the road and not had Steve Smith?
Mm-hmm. Right, because he wouldn't have played, and they might have lost at Green Bay or at Philadelphia. There's no guarantee they would have won that game without a Steve Smith. So I think, you know, you've got to take the bye. You work so hard to get it, and they are a little healthier right now probably than they would have been otherwise.
You've mentioned this is going to be a big game for the fans, and it's completely sold out and all that kind of stuff. Talk about the role the fans can play to help them win.
I think it's huge. I mean, and the crowds this year have just been insane. I mean, I've been at a couple of the games, and just the volume in there is just nuts. And, you know, Coach Rivera, some of the other veterans on the team, like offensive lineman Jordan Gross and Ryan Khalil, I mean, they've pointed out that you know, they see a real difference. I mean, there is, you know, a legitimate home field advantage that can exist in the NFL because of the noise, because of just the atmosphere, getting to play in front of your home crowd. Now, at the same time, it only goes so far. In the first weekend of the NFL playoffs, 3 out of the 4 road teams won. So there's that.
Speak briefly, Scott, about the Ric Flair incident. He gave a motivational speech to the 49ers in which he said his heart was with the 49ers and predicted that they would beat Green Bay and come here and beat us. You, in turn, in print, called him a washed-up 64-year-old former star of a very fake sport who doesn't even live in Charlotte anymore. But he did for a long time. What has the fallout been, if any, from that?
Well, there has certainly been a lot of people up in arms. I'm surprised how much the name Ric Flair still resonates, because I certainly stand by everything I wrote in that column. I honestly don't get his appeal, but Ric Flair, you know, he is he was paid, I guess, to go to speak to the 49ers and said his heart was with the 49ers. He can't really take that back. So, you know, to me, that's good riddance. Ric Flair doesn't need to be the Panthers' number one celebrity fan. If he is, they've got a serious problem.
Very quickly, Michael, we hope to be able to use a phrase to the 49ers after the game this weekend, and that phrase would be,
Ice up, son. Ice up.
Go ahead.
And, of course, there's a fun story behind that. The Monday Night Football game this season, our first one in forever, there was this really big battle between Steve Smith and Patriots defensive back Aqib Talib. Talib left the game early with an injury, but nothing too serious. He played the next week. And anyway, an NFL Network reporter asked Smith about the battle right after the game ended, and here is that exchange.
What happened between you and Talib on the field early in the game?
I don't know. You go ask him, because he didn't finish the game. Ice up, son. Ice up.
And that has just taken off. I mean, you see it on T-shirts all over the place now. Every Panthers game I've been to since, you hear it yelled all the time. Bojangles used it to promote its sweet tea the next day. The NFL Network unveiled a Steve Smith ice sculpture with it carved at the bottom of it. And this one Panthers fan that I talked to this week said that it's now basically the go-to sports insult for anyone in the Charlotte area.
All right, well, we hope to be able to use it against the 49ers at about 5 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. Let's just say a little prayer that happens. Michael Tomczyk, WFAE News reporter, Scott Fowler, sports reporter for the Charlotte Observer. By the way, he's signing copies of his book, 100 Things Panther Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die, Saturday at the Barnes & Noble in Birkdale Village at 1:30. And Barnes & Noble needs the business, evidently, from the story in the paper this morning. Thank you both.